This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over, and it is my great good fortune to be hanging out with Maggie Nelson this morning, and I've been looking forward. I'm frequently looking forward to these interviews, but I've been reading Maggie for a really long time, and I got to go back to some things that I hadn't reread recently, but Like Love is the new essay collection, Essays and Conversations. And this book is so smart and wide-ranging and fun and provocative. And I'm definitely smarter having read it now. But you start with a really cool question that I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to see if you've found a way to answer this now that you've put this book together. How can the attention one pays to art be an act of love or something like it if and when the love object, words, sound, paint, pixels, cannot love you back?
Yeah, there's a kind of funny thing about this book and its title, and that I feel like this conversation, like if you're like partnered with an artist or something, and like if you live in a domestic space where you're always also, there's like different economies of love, you know, like there's like the economy of love and care that I mean, I wrote about this someone on Freedom that takes place like with other people. And then of course there's like love that we have for art and literature, and we use the same word, and it makes sense that we do because it is love, right? It's not just like love. But I think the question that you ask, which kind of has to do with like how we spend our time and how we devote it, I think in making this collection, I do think that love is like, and caring and attention, really, like if attention is a form of love, like is or a deep form of love, I do think that it is like it contagious, like you make more of it in a life with the more, like all that what you do, like paying attention to these books and talking to someone, and like, you know, it does make more and more of that affect in the world. And I do think it is contagious. So in that sense, I do think, you know, that, and if we only loved that which loved us back, that would deeply impoverish the amount of love that there was in the world. Yeah.
That would be so boring. It would be so boring. I like my art to challenge me a little bit. Yeah. And I'm including books in the sort of wider art piece. And obviously we're going to bounce around between art and music and film and books, but probably stick closer to books because that's more what I know.
Sure.
But what I love too is you open and close the book with two of your mentors, mm-hmm. Wayne Kostenbaum and Eileen Miles. And these conversations, I actually went back to one of Wayne's essay collections because I'd been reading him for a minute too, but the 80s and other essays.
Yeah, I love that book, yeah.
It was so fun to sort of eavesdrop on the two of you. I liked the fit too, starting with him and ending with her.
Yeah.
But when you were putting this book together, what were the criteria you used for the pieces? Because you do a lot of sort of outside work, as it were, and a lot of these pieces have been published.
Yep.
There's a rhythm to the collection. There's a rhythm to the essays here that I think is really deliberate.
Well, you know, it was kind of a lucky draw in a sense, in that I think when I had the idea of doing this, because as you're right, that a lot of the pieces have been published before, but a lot of them, and this is kind of a, at least it was kind of a hallmark of my writing life in general, which is that like working in different spheres where maybe everybody wasn't really the same readership, you know? And like a lot of my books have like a kind of a different readership than the other ones. And so I thought if I put them all in one place, you know, then they might find readers that otherwise like they'd passed by. So first I just, you know, scoured kind of my computer and my memory for pieces I'd written. And there were, you know, a lot more than that I found. And then I had this idea that a lot of the conversations that I'd done that ended up in print, you know, things like this, but, you know, things that ended up transcribed from Zoom or done via email, that they kind of made literal the relation, like the social relations that I'm interested in art making anyway. And that also they bring all these opinions and other points of focus into the book that I wouldn't necessarily be my own, which I think is part for me, one of the best things about writing about other people is that, I mean, as you're saying about liking a challenge, like I get tired of myself and what I would bring to the table. So anyway, so I started looking at those conversations too. And then when I picked out kind of the essays I thought were most substantive or that I thought like deserved to get another rodeo, and then did the same with the conversations. And then I laid them out in chronological order. And pretty much that's exactly the book that it was kind of lucky. I mean, they literally are in chronological order. But I think because of the nature of my interests and the people that I'm talking to, and then you add the element of time, like a kind of 20-year period where a lot of the issues that I'm talking about with people, I mean, particularly around like feminist and queer issues, but other issues too, they're actively very, you know, changing in the zeitgeist and all throughout. So I thought that that made an interesting texture as well.
I mean, one of the things I love about reading you is that we have some common reference points, like David Wojnarowicz and Close to the Knives. Like, that was a touchstone collection for me a million years ago. I mean, you studied with Annie Dillard.
Yeah.
But I just bought The Weather in Proust and Black and Blur because of this book. And I had never read Fred Moten, and I hadn't read I'm going through them slowly.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah.
These are not meant to be sort of barreled through.
No, no.
But it was because of the way you wrote about each book. I mean, one of the things I liked about the way you described the Moten, it was like, well, it's the way he approaches the act of reading and the act of writing. Mm-hmm, and it just, he puts sort of a life back into it. And the Sedgwick, I still don't know how I feel yet, but I'm glad I have it. And they are books that I never would have heard about otherwise. I mean, you obviously are a professor, you have a PhD, you've been working in theory for a really long time. I'm a bookseller with a degree in history.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I go where a writer sends me, which is half the fun.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Being a bookseller. But I'm also sort of curious to see where I get with both of these. But they were both pretty big influences for you as well, Moten and Sedgwick, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Fred, you know, thankfully still with us, Sedgwick not. I mean, you know, it's funny because people sometimes in interviews, like other interviewers, they'll be like, well, who are your influences? And I'm like, have you picked up anything I've written much? Because it's like, they're all,
I mean, it's all there.
I don't have like I wish I had like a secret set that I could pull out and it could be interesting, but I really leave it all on the floor. But yeah, no, Moten and Sedgwick. And I think that, but I just want to say that what you're describing about like ordering those books from my talking about them in here is really lovely. And it is partly the reason why I wanted to make this book, was that I just thought there are some people who may know everybody in here, some people who may know nobody in here, some people who may know, as you're kind of saying, like one medium and not others. I find that the art world and the literary world, understandably, some people are very crossed over and some people are not. So I really feel like this book is like a invitation to, you know, party at will, like, you know, like be interested in what you're interested in and not. And as you're saying about Wayne's, you know, my 1980s and other essay collections, you know, I've all of my books to date, except for maybe early poetry collections, you know, are very deliberately kind of arranged. And this one is too. But I also think that, like with Wayne's art criticism and other people, you know, you keep it on the shelf and then you say like, oh, Alice Neal, like, doesn't Hilton have a good essay about Alice, or doesn't Wayne, or doesn't, you know, and then you go look for it. And I think that's perfectly fine as like a way of approaching this book as well.
I think too, I've read it twice now, and I've read it straight through sort of in one sitting to get sort of the spine of what we're going to do here today. And then I went back and was sort of just dipping around. And, you know, there's some writers in here that I love, Samantha Hunt, Darcy Steinke, Hilton Alls. I really like the way you write about Ben Lerner's 1004. I like seeing all of the different pieces mixed in together. And like, I'm kind of notorious for liking action movies, because if I'm watching something on the screen at this point. Like, I
better be worth it.
Netflix thinks I'm a 12-year-old boy.
Right.
Which is fine. But I love the idea that all of these pieces come together in your brain. And that you're sort of pushing, I mean, there's a conversation you're having, I think it's Moira Davey, and she's an artist, and you end up talking a lot about shame, actually. And Carl Ove Nosgaard, who I run back and forth on, I'll be perfectly honest, there's some people who have read all of the books straight through, and I dabble. I will own it. I dabble.
Yeah, yeah.
But can we talk about that conversation too, and how that even came about, and sort of where it went?
I love Moira. I mean, I love everyone in the book. I love Moira. She's one of the people that, when I was saying before about like a literary and art world, you know, some people are very literary in the art world. And she's one of them so much that she published a book a couple of years ago called Index Cards. That's, you know, essays of her own. And then most of her, not all, but a lot of her video art involves her speaking, monologuing, and often about literary figures, whether it's Genet or Mary Shelley or other people. So Moira and her photography and in her videos is, you know, we have a lot of mutual friends and a lot of crossovers of interest and things like that. So, but I think that that essay, like a lot of actually, like a couple essays in this book were commissioned, conversations rather were commissioned by places that ended up not running them.
Okay.
And so it felt like, and that one was commissioned, I can't remember, it was Art Forum or something. And then, oh no, it was for a book that some friends of ours were making on photography. And then the book project never happened, but we had this great conversation and we were like, and then I think it was in an art periodical and then I repurposed it here. Yeah. I mean, Moira's more like, I mean, I'm interested in shame, but it's kind of an overdetermined conversation for me. I think less so for Moira. So she wanted to talk about it more, you know, because I think in her art, she does this really amazing kind of cool, collected kind of Patti Smith-like monologuing about things she's interested in a very kind of flat and yet very compelling affect. And, you know, I'm more of like a bleeding heart and like more of a interested in kind of like the post-shame space where like you've already kind of like, which is probably why Karlova to me feels more like kinship into her. She's kind of more like amazed that like, can you believe it? And I'm like, oh yeah, like this is what we do like in this realm. But I think it was it was a really interesting conversation to talk about that stuff with her and to hear her talk about her own work. I mean, I love hearing other people talk about, I don't love hearing myself talk as much about mine. So I think that's partly why this book was so fun for me is I really like hearing other people talk about their work and I'll answer their questions as per you or anyone, like I'll answer the questions happily, but like I say, you know, one gets tired of oneself. So,
wait, was it Moira who was talking about Ann Carson's response, though? She got an interview that she didn't quite like via email or something, and she kept answering in empty parentheticals.
That is something that I wrote about in the Argonauts, I think.
Okay, sorry.
No, it's all good. I think, and it wasn't an email, it was just like an interview that I read of hers once. Okay. And I love when people seem cool because they like withdraw. And it's like a skill, like it's just like a muscle that I don't have. I mean, I will say I'm learning it a little more as I grow older. I mean, like David Bonarovich and stuff that you mentioned, I think part of it was that I came of age with heroes that were like bringing everything to the table and a lot of them were dying. So it was very moving to me. And I felt like literature was like a game where you didn't. And Annie Dillard actually has very famous quotes about this too, about like spend it all. There'll be fish left over, but you have to spend it, you know? And I think I took that to heart as a very young person and kind of never looked back.
I mean, part of why I raise your conversation with Moira is I feel like shame is a word that mm-hmm. has become almost meaningless. Uh-huh. I mean, it's applied in ways where you're just like, yeah, that's just not useful. Or it's weaponized, honestly, which is maybe not the best word to use to describe it. But I do feel like it's one of those words where we have, as a culture, made it almost meaningless. And it's also a weird concept to start with, but like we're not even interrogating it. We're just kind of throwing it at people and just saying, you know, figure it out. But you wrote an introduction to a book that was pretty seminal for me when I first read it. And I first read it a really long time ago. Darcy Steinke's, it was her, I think it was Darcy's second novel, Suicide Blonde. Grove Press did it in 92, which is when I read it, 91 or 92. I may have read it in Galley because I was a brand new bookseller. And I just remember having my brain blown by that book.
Oh, awesome.
Because so there awesome. Hadn't yeah. been, you know, obviously we had sort of the Genets and, you know, Henry Miller, for better or worse, Uneasnin. There's this whole sort of tradition, right, of what you might call or might describe as just transgressive writing. And then that gets us later to Kathy Acker and Dennis Cooper. I know I'm leaving people out. I'm just sort of using personal reference points here. But Darcy was doing this thing that was really kind of hadn't been done yet. And you call it out in this introduction, which I love. But it's not just that her technique is impressive, and I'm paraphrasing you, it also builds trust. Like, she's asking us to go places, and because the sentences are beautiful, we're willing to do it.
Yeah.
And I had never quite heard anyone write about Darcy that way. And also the critics, and you call this out in the introduction too, a lot of critics didn't know what to do with Suicide Blonde when it first came out. They were like, is this just a dirty book? Like, what do we do with this? Like, how do we deal with the blonde writing about messy stuff? So I went back and started rereading Suicide Blonde because of this essay. And I was like, oh yeah, right. This is like being a young person all over again and like learning how to read. And you talk about Samantha Hunt's The Seas that way too, where you're like, oh yeah, I read it in 2004 and it made me feel like I was a kid understanding what books can do. And I mean, you've been a word person all your life. Like, you have always wanted to write, but can we just talk about your connection to books like Suicide Blonde and The Seas, and just sort of get in there for listeners who have not yet read these essays, because I think they're fabulous. These two particular pieces are so good.
Oh, that's so nice. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, I love what you're saying about Suicide Blonde. And I think that there's a link in a way to another essay in this book, which is on another introduction to Hervé Guibert, because I think a reviewer I quote in that essay says something like, oh, you know, he was just really out to like shock the bourgeoisie, you know, with the sexual details of his life and stuff. And a similar comments like about Suicide Blonde. And I think, you know, if there's I don't know if it's conscious or unconscious, but when I look at, you know, a book like Love, I really see over and over again, I'm attracted to, and I'm trying to pay homage to people who, as you said, are basically just like somewhere else, you know, beyond what the reviewers in the moment can see. They're kind of like, and they're like, what to do with this? And so they're using all their pat things they can come up with about shock and women or shame or whatever they're coming up with. And like all the action of the book is taking place somewhere else. And they're just not there. And it's just kind of sad because you're watching them like drag it back into their gestalt that like can't serve it. So I think some of these pieces are also trying to look back on moments, like you say, with Suicide Blonde, and just be like, yeah, Darcy, I mean, especially in Darcy's case, in Steinke's case, I mean, in Kubera's case in a way, but differently because him being a gay man, but in Steinke's case, you know, it has to do with also what kind of like female transgression like is audible or possible. And also the non-understanding that people have sometimes that there's like a canon of writing or a tradition that's not just about transgression. It's really about, I'm thinking about the Matthew Barney essay in this book where, yeah, I talk about the differences between subversion, transgression, and perversion. Like some of it, the writing is just perverted. Like, I mean that in a good way. In a good, yeah, way. It's not actually trying to make anyone upset. It's just actually like beautiful language about messy, perverted things, you know? And I think, and that's something that's like a space that some people don't quite understand.
But also, don't we need to hold two things at the same time, right? Like, don't you have to have the ugly in order to have the beautiful? I think context is the thing we keep sort of, I don't know, zoning out on. I mean, well, it's more than a couple of years ago at this point, but the Guggenheim did a retrospective of the Barney Cremaster films. Mm-hmm. And I made it through three.
Uh-huh.
And then I, yep, was good. And all props. I mean, listen, all props. Do your thing, dude. I get it. Like, I made it through three. And that was enough. And I was good. But I'm still glad I saw those. Like, I'm still glad that I've been able to see, you know, I have access to pretty great stuff living in New York. And like, you get to see interesting, smart stuff that you might not otherwise see. Like, I've told this story before, but like, I finally, and this is years ago, but I finally saw Demoiselle d'Avignon, mm-hmm, like on the actual wall, because it's not a painting that reproduces well. Like, you see it in a textbook and it's just like,
whatever.
That's, yeah, what everyone got super stoked about. Right. I don't,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you see it on the wall and you're like,
yeah,
oh. And I feel that way when I'm reading your essays in Like Love. Like, I kept going back and jumping online. Like, if I didn't know the physical reference, I would just go look it up and I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I love Kara Walker. I've been able to see a lot of her work. What, in real life? What are we calling this? Offline. But to hear this new piece that's at the New School described, it's like, yeah, I would really love to see that, except I think you have to actually be a member of the community in order to get it. So, okay, I'll live. But like, she's someone who's wildly vibrant and does really interesting stuff. And also, like you, will challenge what a lot of us consider conventional narratives.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's another reason why I wanted to make this book was just also that, you know, all acts of collection and what you choose to spend your attention on is like canon making in a way. And, you know, there's obviously a certain kinds of taste of mine that determine where I want, you know, where I've wanted to spend my attention. And certainly, as you're talking about making it through only three of the Cremasters or other things, or like, or the difficulty of some of Kara's work that has people felt over time, like, I mean, certain artists I'm writing about, like Tala Madani, another in there, They're an Iranian American painter is really incredible. I mean, Carolee Schneeman. I mean, I like people who push limits, and I really value art as a place to do that, which I think I wrote about quite at length on Freedom. And I think it's not saying like anything goes, but, you know, the kind of love it or hate it, or can only take three of them or whatever, the kind of like radical elaboration of imagination is something like the Cream Masters is just something that the world is, you know, like a better place for, like, in my opinion, like, and so it's like, it's incredible that there are artists and that they do these things. It really is to me, you know.
The Carolee Schneeman piece that you wrote, I hadn't been familiar with her at all, but it strikes me that performance art, there has to be a commitment there. And I'm partially thinking about this because I just interviewed Lisa Coe from Memory Piece, and one of her characters in that book is a performance artist and draws from folks who know performance art. You will recognize some of the influences. I'm a little slow when it comes to performance art, but I appreciate the commitment and I appreciate the form. And I'm also thinking of Kaveh Akbar's new novel, Martyr. There's a performance artist in that book who is amazing. And I love the way you capture the energy of Carolee on the page, because I think too, performance art went through a phase in our society where people were like, is that even art? And it's like, well, actually, this is the conversation we need to have.
Yeah. I mean, sadly, I don't see as much live performance as I used to when I was a New Yorker. But when I first moved to New York as a young person, I was involved in a dance scene and a performance scene that, and, you know, poetry, which I was more involved in at that time, and the poetry project at St. Mark's Church where I worked for a time. You know, all of that is a very poetry as, you know, literature as performance kind of a scene. And Eileen Miles is somebody who was really, whose performance of their poetry was really meaningful to me. And that kind of presencing and energy and I guess risk, that's what I thought you were going to say when you were saying like all people who work with their bodies in a certain way involve a certain kind of risk. And there are many risks. I mean, it can be personal risk to your bodily safety or integrity. It can just be the risk of any performance failing. You know, there's elements of surprise and what happens in live performance that are different than writing a book. But there's also the risk that comes with the fact that it's not saleable, you know, and that performance is not, and that even people like Carolee, who are probably, you know, among the world's most famous performance artists, in addition to other things she did, you know, it did not translate into, you know, financial security, which is true for most people who've made performance a key feature of their lives. And I think for me, that also, you know, if you write about art, as I do a fair amount, and sometimes people who are not in the art world want to ask a lot of questions about institutions and big money and art fairs and, you know, toxic philanthropy and all these things that like super matter and they're super interesting. But, you know, to me, I have a much more kind of DIY, like back on the ground level, like, and I think performance is partly where that comes from of like, yeah, a lot of art doesn't sell. Like a lot of people who you're talking about are not, they may be famous culturally, but they're not, I mean, to 25 people, I mean, you know, to like a small amount of people and not in a way that, you know, their cultural capital is not financial capital. And so I just think people forget how broad the art making scene is and can get lost in a kind of fantasy of the 1%, which is real and toxic, but it's not where most art happens. You know?
Well, also I'm thinking about things like public art. I mean, Keith Haring, there's... Mm-hmm. Someone just ran a giant review saying, was Keith Haring an artist or was he a sellout? And I'm like, slow down. Like, yeah. I thought we had this conversation.
Good
like,
point. Yeah, slow down. Yeah.
Wait. Didn't we have this conversation 30 years ago? Like, what's so terrible about making art available to people? Certainly in LA, like, there are people trying to do public art in a new way here. And, you know, New York has always had sort of, for a long time, it was easier to be creative in New York or LA because it was, you could afford to live there. And now obviously that is changing stuff, but Hilton Ahls, all of this brings me to Hilton Ahls because he's curating art shows now. I mean, he did the Toni Morrison show at Princeton University. He's done some pieces in New York. Like there was a Baldwin show that you write about as well, but you quote him as saying, well, sometimes Hilton just says his art is other people. And I kind of feel that way about you too, that part of what you're doing is just seeing where this story goes.
I don't think when Hilton says that it's like a dodge or something, you know? Like,
I don't think it is at all.
But I think it actually can feel like that from the point of view of the creator when you're kind of I mean, specifically, I mean, I think he's maybe talking more about his curation work than maybe his books or something. He's published two books. Maybe now there's a couple smaller ones, like a little book on Prince. But, you know, so much of the reviewing and so much of the curating, you know, really is moving around other people and showcasing things you want to showcase. He did a big Didion show here at in LA. And I mean, he's done a bunch of things. But I think that, you know, I haven't really gone. I mean, I think Hilton, I don't want to speak for him, but I think probably because of all the years of being a critic, you know, has just done a lot more work or is more comfortable in that space. And I think that I am much more, I mean, he and I have talked about this and joked about it, but I'm much more kind of obsessed with the book form and have written a lot of books that are very self-consciously, you know, lyric books unto themselves. And in some sense, this book, Like Love, is a kind of like coming out story in a way for me to kind of be like, oh, actually, I do some work like that. It's kind of been not like my secret, but it's been like a place where when I'm like between projects or something, I'll take on an art essay or something just to kind of, you know, like if something's interesting to me, just so it's a way of like keeping in the mix and keeping thinking and keeping writing, even if I'm not, you know, deep in a book project of my own. But I love that spirit of Hilton's, and I rely really heavily on Hilton's words in the introduction, because I think that he is somebody who both in his practice and in his own writing life has really made, you know, more of a career of this like love phenomenon but showing also, this is, I think, kind of key, is that you're not in academia. So God bless you. This is not, you don't need to get involved with this, but maybe it's relevant to book selling. I don't know. But like in academia, there's been a kind of long conversation in the last 20 years or so about kind of criticism of a certain kind, a kind of paranoid taking apart, deconstructive criticism, reaching a kind of end game, and something maybe called post-critique that might take its place. And so there've been a lot of theorizing about whether or not that post-critique, like Rita Felsky is one of the people who's written a lot about this. Like, should we re-theorize why we're attached to art, like, or literature? Like, should we up kind of why we got into this in the first place, you know, since if it's not just going to be political deconstruction and kind of showing why everything's wrong or bad, basically, what are the other things that, you know, are left? But I think sometimes people get worried, and I worry about this too, because I grew up amongst hippies and I'm not really partial to like a kumbaya approach to life. But I think people worry that if you get involved in a, like a love space with writing about art and literature, that there's not going to be much to say. There might be not rigor. You might lose critical edge. And Hilton, I guess I'm trying to get to, is somebody for me that really exists heavily in that love space, but does not lose edge, does not lose rigor, does not lose activity. And I think, and the same is true for Wayne and for Eileen, like they're not going to waste their time writing a bunch of essays about things they think are crap. It's just that their life's too short. It doesn't mean that you've lost all acumen, you know.
And I mean, I'm going to see your hippie upbringing and raise you a bunch of cold New Englanders.
Okay, great.
So, I mean, hi, ex-Bostonian. Yeah. But the way we were sort of taught to think about art was this very rarefied thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I am totally making fun of that voice. But, you know, everything was kind of on a shelf, right? And it had to be sort of vetted, as it were, by the rest of the universe. And I actually think that that's not always the most helpful thing. And it was funny, I went back to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston for the first time in decades, back in January, and I was like, this building is tiny. Mm-hmm. And it was so little compared to what I thought it was. And when I was a kid, I thought it was the whole world, and I can't believe how big this building is and everything else. And the same things are in the same places. And I'm like, oh, right. Right. Or like here on the West Coast, there are a couple of galleries at the Huntington, all respect to the Huntington, but like it's literally art from New England and upstate New York and Europe that's been sort of transferred out here. And I'm like, but we're in the West. Don't we have our own traditions? Like, why am I looking at this 50-foot painting that I could have seen at the Met or the MFA or, you know, what have you? And I don't think we have to sacrifice rigor if we sit in the space that Hilton Alls is sitting in or that you've put Like Love into. I think love is one of those words where we have to take the meaning back and redefine it. And, you know, freedom, shame, all of these words that have somehow, and this is the bulk of your work, right? Like you're questioning all of this, which is the fun of reading you. But like what you're doing in Bluettes or what's happening in the Argonauts, I just, the way you use language to politely interrogate what we're doing, like, how do you live without art? You don't, well, in my way of thinking, you don't live without art, but like art could be a great sunrise or a great sunset that you just catch out of the corner of your eye. Like, I think there's so much beauty in a world that is admittedly a hot mess right now and bad things are happening. And I cannot believe that we're standing on the lip of the volcano like this. But at the same time, like watching you move around in these essays and holding the thing as, I mean, Bjork, you've got a piece with Bjork in here. And then a riff that you did on Prince, and all of those pieces fit together for me. And they fit together though with Gilbert and the earlier work or Darcy or Samantha Hunt. I don't think you can separate, or I would like us to not separate all of the artistic influences.
Yeah, it was really funny because there was like at the end of the Sam Hunt essay, I had quoted this Bjork song and then I was told that we had to take it out because it'd be too hard to get permissions. And I was like, but what if there's a conversation with her in the same book? Like, can that just take care of it, you know? But yeah, no, there were a lot of crossovers of things, which is not surprising, you know, because I think certain sensibilities find each other, but, you know, certain sensibilities, certain people in the book, like, don't know each other either. And so that's exciting too.
Yeah, I got a lot of joy out of reading this book. I got a lot of joy. And there are a couple of pieces where I had to sort of sit and stop and think. I mean, this is not a book to be raced through at all. Right. But I really enjoyed having your voice in my ear.
Oh, that's so nice. I'm not sure everybody does, so it's great.
Well, I liked it.
I mean, I'm always like, if you don't like it, don't read it. Like, I don't care. Like, but in terms of having my voice in your ear, but I think, I mean, I'm really glad to hear that because, as you say, there's a lot that is a hot mess. And I think part of what was fun about especially these conversations and putting them together was that, like, I mean, it sounds so cliche and, you know, back to my hippie roots, but like, you know, we can feel very alone. And these conversations are me like hashing out with people who I know really well or don't know really well a lot of the things that we care about the most and that we want to know what each other think about. And we don't know what we think. And we say, like, over and over again, when I was rereading these conversations, they say things like, does that sound right to you? Or, you know, what would you add to that? Or, you know, like, do you think I got this wrong? You know, just kind of these pushings and queryings, because we really do want to know what each other thinks, you know, in a world where people often don't seem to really want to be able to behold or know what other people around them are thinking or feeling. They really are places where, you know, and a lot of them, whether it's Jacqueline Rose, who's a well-known British psychoanalytic feminist critic, or other people, like, I really want to know what Jacqueline thinks, like, about, you know, rising autocracy and its relationship to psychic life. Like, I desperately want to know, you know. Some of them are more friendly tete-a-tetes, and other ones are also, I think, have a real feeling of like, we can't do this. So we can't do this without each other and without like our shared knowledge pool, or I can't, I know. So
you said something in your conversation though with Eileen Miles that I'm still thinking about. Mm. And it's part of a larger sort of riff on your lived experience of writing, but you say, I think a lot of us began writing as a way of getting privacy and feeling free and feeling alone. Mm-hmm. I get the feeling free. I get the feeling alone. Mm-hmm. Getting privacy though, can I ask you, as you can tell, I'm still thinking about it. I'm like, as a writer, do you get privacy? And I'm not talking about, you know, some of the writing you've done. I mean, this is all sort of very critical. You're not necessarily in like Love the way you are in The Argonauts, right?
Well, I think when I say start as a writer, I'm imagining myself as like a 12 or 13 year old person writing poetry in my room. And I think, I guess in that context, I meant privacy from your domestic space, privacy from people who don't care how you feel, privacy, like, you know, you learn about yourself and your psychic life. And you kind of force a space for it to be seen or heard. You know, publishing is a different question. And that's just something that like unfolds over a life. Because I think what I was trying to get at with Eileen was that, especially for those of us who work in nonfiction, you know, this kind of combined practice of only being able to create things that matter from touching like the most vulnerable and unknown, bordering on unknowable places, like in your psychic life, to kind of, whether they're political questions about freedom or whether they're personal questions about, you know, heartbreak or despair or what, you know, whatever they are, they're, that's the writing discovery process. And so how you continue to do that and keep pretending like no one's looking, if people begin to look, is that's a whole kind of other question, you know.
Once you had Like Love together and had picked out all of the pieces that were going to be here, mm-hmm. did anything actually surprise you? I mean, some of this work is pretty recent.
Yeah.
Some of it makes perfect sense to me in mm-hmm. the flow of your body of work and sort of what you were working on book-wise at the time. But I mean, are you still in a place where you can do that and surprise yourself?
Well, I didn't kind of re-surprise myself in that I'd already written these things. So I, certainly in my own other writing I'm doing in my life okay. right now, you know, surprising yourself has to be the name of the game, or else, you know, the moribund task of repeating things you have already done or know would take hold. But I do think in this book, I think you said before that you felt a lot of joy, but that it wasn't always like a breezy read. I think when I started putting it together, I thought of some of this writing as like, oh, this will be fun because all this writing is kind of like a breezier break from my more dense things. And it was to a happy surprise. It was actually a meatier, like there was like more meat on the bones of some, like I was happy because it made me realize that these acts of attention had been very involved. And, but because they're more itinerant, like a book might take like between like 1 to 5 years, and say some of these essays might've been like a 3-month immersion. I don't remember them as being so researched or dense or grappling with a hard thought. And then I saw them and I was like, oh no, they all were. They were just doing so in a much more finite space, you know, than book projects. So.
But you do also sort of mention that you haven't worked on poetry the way you did prior to coming out to Los Angeles, right? Like it's kind of changed a little bit. And I went back and read Something Bright Then Holes as I was getting ready for this, and still holds for me. Still.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Really. And it is very much New York in a moment.
I know I'm going to New York in, I don't know when, May, for this book. And I'm doing something at a place like on the Gowanus. And I'm such a not New Yorker now that I was like, on the Gowanus? I'm like, do they know what it's like there? And then it's like, I haven't even been back since it became something else. So that'll be a very interesting trip.
I think you are going to get a lot of material out of it, is what I'm thinking.
I think it'll follow a pretty normative script. I think there's a Whole Foods or something. So
there probably is. Yeah. There probably, if there's not a Whole Foods, there's a Trader Joe's, but I think there is a Whole Foods. But coming back to, you've also said you've sort of been thinking in book length projects. And of course, here we are talking about, you know, a collection of essays that have been written sort of as you've been doing the book projects. But I mean, obviously your craft ebbs and flows and changes and evolves as you do as a human being, but really just thinking in book projects, like what are you getting from book length work that you weren't necessarily getting from other pieces that sustained you previously?
I mean, it's weird because Annie Dillard, who you mentioned before, like Annie was, you know, probably this is true of any teacher that you have early on, but she would just say things that at the time seemed really whatever. And then of course you thought about them for the rest of your life, but people would say, how do you write something longer? And she would say, you write small things and put them together, you know, and like, duh, right? But I think, you know, in some ways there isn't really a distinction between, like, you know, small things can be words that you put together to make a sentence. Small things can be essays that you collate into a book. Small things can be numbered propositions, like in Bluets. I mean, small things can be anything. I think it's maybe more just that, like, I worked for a long time in lyric poetry, and that was really wonderful, like in my teens and 20s, as a kind of laboratory for sound and for making things happen in a condensed space. And I'm very impatient with prose that doesn't, you know, if I read a few flabby sentences, I'm like, I don't know, like I'm out. I just don't care enough about plot or character or anything to care about a flabby sentence, you know? But after all that time with lyric poems, I just, you know, I started, I guess I wrote a book called Jane and Murder, which told like a narrative in poems. And then that was 2005, and then published 2 books of prose shortly thereafter. One was a book about the New York School, poetry and painting, and the other was a kind of stab at writing a kind of true crime memoir called The Red Parts. And, you know, from there, like prose projects that had a particular scope just had more grip on me. But I don't know when I start something how long it's going to be. I just finished a really short thing based on dreams that will come out next year that is 54 manuscript pages, very short, you know, like so short. I'm like, well, that's fine. Like Bluets was 90. Like, that's fine. Like, it should be short. You know, like, I don't really know before I start, like, about the length. So it would be kind of hard to say I only care about the book, but I do just like, you know, it's kind of like working on like a vinyl record or something, like just kind of imagining the thing with like the liner notes and the A side and the B side. Like, it's just a kind of format that I like to think about more than I think about. I mean, I have some very good friends who you probably know, like Yul Abyss or other people who I think of as really good at moving between the essay and then like a long form. I've never written a book like Yula's book of like her books of essays. They're just, it's not like something I know how to do very well.
I just think sometimes form is dictated by the idea.
And yes, you just, absolutely.
You know it when you see it. I mean, that's as a bookseller, that's kind of been my modus operandi for a really long time, which is I can't. Sometimes you can explain it and sometimes it's just like, I know it.
It's
making all of the nerve endings go and there's something here. Okay. So you've got the tiny thing coming next year from Dreams. Is there anything else that you might be working on that we can talk about?
Not that I know of right now.
Okay. Fair. Maggie Nelson, thank you so much for joining us on Poured Over. Like Love is out now. It's your 11th book. There's so much great backlist to check out too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.